A sante sana Yesu. A sante sana Yesu.
A sante sana Yesu.
Moyoni.
Moyoni.
Asante is the word for thank you. And sana is very much. Yesu is Jesus. Moyo is heart. But when you have a suffix on it, ni, it means in my heart. Let's do it by beginning in English form of it, so that when you translate the words, it will be easier. Thank you, Jesus. Thank you, Jesus. Thank you, Jesus, in my heart. Thank you, Jesus. Thank you, Jesus. Thank you, Jesus, in my heart.
Is that too high?
Okay, now Swahili. The language is Swahili. Swahili, can you say it?
Swahili.
Excellent.
Swahili.
Asante sana Yesu. Asante sana Yesu. Asante sana Yesu moyoni. Asante sana Yesu. Asante sana Yesu. Asante sana Yesu moyoni.
I think after such a moving Bible study this morning, it's very difficult, and the dynamism and the fact that I saw it coming deep from the heart of our friend, it's very difficult to follow up. And I will not, I cannot promise that I will keep up the report that has been said. When I looked at the kiosk, the word that was picked to present this session, that was recreating relationship. It was one of the phrases that we had used in what we thought when I discussed with Cindy. And I found it very interesting that particular phrase is the one that they picked up to highlight. Because in my work, more often than not, I am accused of breaking relationships, not recreating relationships. And many times where we work, we sit once on one wing and I'm on another wing with another organization, but we share certain facilities. There are about 10, 15 institutions in the same company, but there are certain common facilities that we share, like worship, central services, mailing, and upkeep, and such other services, personnel services. And most of the times, Musibi comes home and she asks me, what is it that you are doing with the people? You know, they, many places I go to, they're all talking about this man who is not giving them, who is so demanding and doesn't seem to understand we are human beings. So I may not be the best person to talk about the creating relationship, but I would rather look at this from the perspective of recreating relationship, not just in terms of human relationship only, but in terms of broken relationship that arises due to poverty, and how you build bridges, and the different communities are rebuilding bridges, so that you don't have one sector of the poor and one sector of the rich. And I think the Bible study this morning, I found it very, in terms of what we need to address, the different parties we need to address ourselves. It is not going to be on Africa. Africa, I will use Africa as one of the case studies, a few communities in Africa. But I have other several case studies because our work involves a different continent, from Asia, from Latin America, and maybe from part of Europe, because it's very interesting when you look at this, because there is something that goes that is common among them. Initially, when I started, of course, my initial exposure was only to Africa, and even in Africa, was only to a few countries. When we started working with communities in other regions, every community worked with, they say, look, our problems are unique. Our problems of poverty are unique. You go to Philippines, you know, our problems of poverty are unique. You go to India, you know, our problems of poverty are unique. You go to Ecuador. But when you put the different threads together, there are certain things that come into mind. And there are certain things that you find. Communities are essentially using the same strategy to be able to respond. They may vary depending on the local circumstances. So my emphasis will be on micro issues. I have not looked at macro issues. So much has been written about macro issues that affect poverty, economics, trade. However, there are two items I'd like to highlight. One of them is debt. And the debt crisis. I know that since the late 70s and a part of the early 80s, because of the different mechanisms that were established to try to respond to the problems of the debt crisis, it is not as highlighted, does not appear to be as significant in several countries as it was then. But the effects and the impact of the debt crisis in several communities, people are still paying for it. We have countries in Africa where the debt, the external debt, is equal to their gross national product. We have countries where the amount of money that they are using to service external debt is many times more than the amount they are using on health and education. We have countries where, basically, to be able to pay the external debt, they have had to cut back on basic social services. Countries like Mozambique, of the 40 poorest countries in the world, about 25 or 26 are in Africa. Now, but you find that in order for them to get even listened to in terms of to be able to service the debt, they have the mechanism that have been established, except very, very recently, in the case of Uganda, very, very recently. These are mechanisms that are giving them more debt to be able to service the existing debt so that they can have credibility, so-called credit worthiness, so that then they are able to attract what is now more seen as the answer to problems of poverty. By certain quotas, attract foreign investment, so that then the foreign investment, you know, that way, then be able to address issues. That is one issue I'd like to highlight. The other issue I'd like to highlight is the question of trade. Musidi mentioned the other day about World Trade Organization, but I want to, not necessarily to refer to a particular institution, but the terms of trade, because the countries that are least, are most disadvantaged, are also the countries that the terms of trade are most in their disfavor. They are most disadvantaged also in terms of trade. The commodities or the products that they produce sell much less. If you are producing coffee, for example, or tea, or cocoa, the tons of coffee or cocoa that you need in order to buy a tractor, because you are not manufacturing a tractor, they work against the cocoa producer. So that increasingly you have to produce more in order to try to get the same type of goods that we are buying before. Now, related to this is the new openness that is demanded, because openness in terms of trade, and then there is a lot of merit in terms of opening trade and removing barriers so that you can be able to compete. But you see, if you ask me to compete 100 yards with a world record holder, I mean, I literally stand no chance. So effectively, you're asking people who have very, very differing capacities to be able to compete. How do you bring them to be able to compete equally? So although there are merits in a number of new initiatives that world governments are introducing, but these initiatives are not necessarily taking into account the capacity of the different countries to be able to compete. Now, related to this also is the question of technology. And I mean, it's a fact, if you have better communication, then you are closer to the market, not only in terms of telephones. A country like Zaire, you say you hardly have a kilometer in the rural areas in any form of paved road. So people are basically locked up. Somebody said that, Poden village is very remote, but it is not. Because you see, there is a way of getting here, and the things work on time. You know, you get to the boat at a particular time, you know, when you're going to get here. It's not necessarily the case in several of the poor countries. So the basic infrastructure, social infrastructure, on the basis of which people can be able to use their own innovation and creativity, those structures are not there. So the macro issues are equally important. But if you address macro issues only without looking at the micro issues, and that seems to be what is happening. Because when you do that, then you believe once you have solved the macro issues, then you have the trickle-down effect. You know, things will finally trickle down, and hopefully, they will start to grow. That hasn't worked for many years. I doubt it will work. Now, to come back to the question of self-reliance for promotion of socioeconomic justice. In 1991, we had a meeting in Harare, Zimbabwe. We had invited people from the region, Southern and East African region. All of these were representatives of the churches, but people were in different fields. But as organizers, we have the discretion to invite the resource persons. So I had invited a pastor from Lesotho to come and talk on issues of poverty in his country. Now, there were three other delegates from the churches who were coming from Lesotho. One of them was a priest of a seminary, was a priest of an agriculture. The other two were directors in big government departments. One of them was a scientist, and the other one was a finance person, an accountant, a qualified general accountant. But they were working, they give time like four of us to give time to your church. So they have been nominated by the church to come to the meeting. When they got to the airport in Harare, they were traveling together, but they did not realize they were coming to the same meeting. The three knew they were coming to the same meeting, but they did not expect, they saw the other person, they recognized him, the other person had invited, but they did not expect that he was coming to the same meeting with them. So they get their hot at the migration. The pastor is not allowed to throw. Why? Because he had only one way ticket. He couldn't afford because we were operating on a reimbursement basis. So he had hoped that he would pay one way. And then when he comes, we'll both reimburse him and pay him a ticket back. Now, it wasn't a lot of money for the others. So they actually left him there. They could have or guaranteed or paid for. All he needed to do is produce evidence that he had money to buy a return ticket, but he didn't have the money. They actually left him at the airport. So I only got word about 8 in the evening. And so I went there, I signed the necessary guarantees, and he came out. When he came out, I had already met these people. The ones who came earlier, they did not tell me that they left somebody who was coming to the meeting at the airport. When they realized that he had come, around midnight, they sent a delegate to me, someone who woke me up. And they told me, look, if this person is going to participate in the meeting, we are going home. So I sent a word back, and the person explained. So I sent a message back. If you have to go home, I regret it. But the reasons you are giving do not justify to send this person home. The animosity was so great. They did not go home. Come the day this person was making a presentation, and he sat, so he was in the front there, like I am, and his other colleagues were sitting around there. His first statement was, look, in our country, we have two words, the words of the rich, the words of the poor. My friends there belong to one word we never meet. But that's the smaller word. And I belong to the other word, which is the majority in our country. And I'm so happy that at least even if we don't talk, we can sit around, we can be in the same room. Now, all of us were Christians, or at least we proclaimed the Christian faith. All of them were church-going people. They were all committed to working for their own church. One point am I trying to make? That in many cases, we actually don't realize that although we say we may be in a fellowship, we may not actually realize that we are actually not in a fellowship because of huge economic disparities. This was for the church I worship when I'm in Kenya. We meet. After that, there are people who live in the slums. That's where they go. There are people who live in other areas. That's where they go. You see, but we sit in that we every Sunday, you know, we come and we worship the same God. Now, in that meeting in Harare, right at the end, because of what happened, many things happened. There were a lot of discussions, very honest discussions. So we finally, all of us embraced each other, and we had a separate meeting with the four of them. But somebody said today in the morning, it looked like a Sunday, you know, because when they went back to their own separate groups. And up to today, they keep writing to me because there was a call to go back and organize a program of how to address the issues of poverty. So the three colleagues went back to their own normal way of doing things, and he went back to the same community that he lived with. 1992, I visited one of the countries in Latin America. I think it's pretty far, not to name it. And we had a meeting with church leaders. There was a very critical issue at stake, because we had, for many years, we had exclusively worked with the church. But we had reached a point where we had seen, look, we are not reaching the people we are supposed to reach. The priorities that we are looking at were basically the structure, the church structure priorities. That the church needs a fast personage, the church needs a new worship sanctuary, it needs a new nursery school. But the other aspect of the work of working with the poor in a way that will help the poor to be able to stand on their own, it really was never addressed seriously. So we had more or less told them, look, the game is up. That's why we get into trouble, as you see me keep hearing. We said, look, we have continued this way for so many years, actually 20 years at that time. But yet, we have no meaningful program of working with the poor. One of the churches took this as a very serious challenge to their ministry. Because this church started in Europe way back, and they moved and they established, they were quite strong in this country. And the very reason that they actually started in Europe themselves was because they needed to work with the poor, the poor community. And that was so central to their mission. Now, for somebody to come and say, look, you don't seem to be getting it. Now, they simply couldn't take that. Now, we had a 3-hour meeting, and regrettably, we decided, we all mutually agreed to part ways. They said, and the critical issue was that we were now asking, okay, you have pastors and other people who are working in the church. We want to form a new organization where you have the poor, the representatives of the poor, nominated by the poor, who will come and sit and help set the priorities. That was the critical issue. They say no, because we know what they need. These are our pastors, they are with them every day. We said yes, but nothing has changed. You know, we have continued doing the same things without having any meaningful impact. So we need to look at new ways of dealing with this. And if we have to look at new ways, then you have to involve the people that you intend to work with and work for. You involve them in terms of setting priorities. Let them design and define what their priorities are. Nevertheless, we formed a new organization. This particular church is one of the biggest in the country. They say they will not participate, and they opted out. It was very sad for us. However, they did not prohibit any of their members who want to participate in the program. So, in fact, we invited them in their own individual capacities, some of their own members, to participate in the program. And although it's the church not involved in the management, but you know, we still have very, very good relationship. My point, and from the experience that we have seen, it's so easy to decide for people. And I think that's one of the biggest problems, that from my short experience, I have worked that we decide for the poor. We know what their needs are. And normally, when we are judging the competence of the people, we judge on the basis of the levels of education. He's not a lawyer, he's not an accountant, he's not a qualified social worker, has not been to school. But you see, in matters of life, who else really is the best judge other than the person themselves? Because all these other, whether it's technology, whether it's a financial skill, whether it's a theological skill, I mean, these are tools. And they only become relevant after you have agreed on which journey, which direction, which priorities. Then you start looking at the tool that you need to be able to achieve that. But more often than not, we confuse, at least from what I have seen myself. And then in the process, you see, we marginalize the people who are already marginalized. We marginalize them even more. And people lose their self-worth. They lose their dignity. The concept of self-reliance, for us, it is not just in terms of economic self-reliance. It is much wider, because sometimes what people need is not money. In fact, in many cases, you may find out that what people need is not money. What people need is ideas. What people may need is a way of accompanying them, for them to be able to realize themselves. And then later on, you may find money may become necessary, but you also might find other substitutes that may be available within a community. One of the most commonly held views, at least in the earlier years when you started, and you talk, I belong to a professional organization myself in Kenya, you know, and it's very easy when people are sitting and they're talking. Why are people poor? It's not unusual to hear that people are poor because they are lazy. Or they are poor because they are useless. They have no interest in improving their own welfare. Even in the organization I'm working with, that was a big issue in 1990. You have bankers, private Swiss bankers, you know. But you find a farmer, a mother who leaves at 6 in the morning, walk maybe 10 kilometers or more to cultivate a piece of land, and is there the whole day and comes back, the farmer may still be poor, but that farmer may be the most hardworking. The question is, what rewards, what is the reward for her labor, and what's the reward for her product? Even in terms of helping a community to be able to take charge of their own lives, both politically and socially, so that they have their own institutions and they are strong enough, you put them in a level where they can advocate and they can negotiate. Indeed, even negotiate and take their own charge into account. Or when there is a political party, because I only read about campaigning around here. I only read about it in big monies. And this seems to be the trend. elsewhere, even where I come from. But when a politician, they elect a politician, and the politician disappears, it's not the same here. He's elected, the constituency is 800 kilometers away, go to the capital city, only remember the constituency during the election time. And it comes with sugar. You know, we're talking about very basics, not millions. You know, sugar, you know, salt, a 2 kilogram packet of maize, which is the staple food, or rice, and then distributes, you know, then gets the votes. And then the politician goes away again. So the question is, that community, what they need is to be helped to realize their own rights and their own responsibilities so that they can be able to make informed decisions. So the slides I want to share with you, I want to illustrate this with a few case studies from different countries. Musimbi is warning me that I'm running out of time. And what I would like you to look at, we'll probably move a little bit faster. Majority of the people that we'll be seeing are either semi-literate or illiterate. But the way they have been able to come up themselves on their own, with very little assistance from outside, I think that for me is the story. I just went quickly over that because we'll look at that tomorrow. What we operate is a revolving fund credit system. When a farmer pays, that money goes into a revolving fund, and that money is related to another farmer. That's the basic principle. So that if we are operating in Ecuador, for example, when we send funds to Ecuador, they are not, when people pay back, that money is not sent back to us. Although the ownership remains with us, the money still remains in Ecuador, so that it continues being reused and recycled in Ecuador. Until such time they don't need it, then they return that money to us, and then we can use it in other countries. But we look at this a little bit more tomorrow. Now, this is one of the organizations that we work with in India. It's a member organization of the institution that we have created in India. This is what I mentioned, that in terms of self-grants, it's primarily a women's organization. They operate in 25 villages, now with 600 members. You see, the first phase when they enter a community into a village, the first thing that they look at is formation of groups, and the entry point is health and communication. And I have seen some of they do this mainly through drama, this particular organization. As I said, you see, majority of the people are illiterate or semi-literate. And in this particular case, 99% of them are Hindus, not Christians. The second phase is only in the second phase after they have looked at the first phase, when they start looking at the different options that they need to be able to improve their own welfare. And that's where the question of either credit or other forms of assistance comes in. The third phase is social awareness. And that is very important because it is at that level when that's the education and training that was mentioned. And the education and training in this case is not in ABC or 1, 2, 3, but in terms of how they can be able to negotiate with the government and the women. And India is one of the most patriarchal country. So he's very critical. And even the reason why they start with health-related issues is simply because women can be allowed to go out and discuss health issues. If you say they are going out to discuss awareness and civil rights, then they are not going to be allowed to come out. Yeah. And these are some of the activities that they engage in. One of the things, this is a passbook. As they pay the loan, because we work with loans, as they pay the loans, there is a provision where you pay more than the loan you have received. And what you pay more goes into a savings mechanism. So that next time they want to come and borrow, they borrow less. So that over time, they create their own savings mechanism so that they are not going to be able to depend only on an outsider, yeah, whether it is loan or grant. These are some of the activities that they undertake. Now, this is in Kenya. It's called the Gesha Women's Group. This is zero grazing. Most of the people are, but this particular group has 25 women. They are on 1 acre, no, quarter of an acre plot because of population, high population growth. And so they would go out, either they rent another piece of land or the same piece of land. They plant the grass for cows. Where we come in is what they get is a loan to help them to buy a cow. And one cow is very expensive because we're talking about, we'll be talking about $500 to $600. Now that may not be a lot of money here. The one we have just seen for India, you know, the average loan is $60. $60 can make a difference in the life of a family on a long-term basis. This is in Uganda, again, zero grazing. Dairy farming is very important because not only do you get extra income, but in addition, it has a nutritional effect so that the family is able to afford milk. And that has a big impact in the health of the health of the children. In Uganda, this is probably where it is. It is the largest, out of about $600,000, about $400,000 loan that they gave last year was for women for dairy programs like this. Now this is in Colombia, a country which is beset with violence, a lot of violence. We were there in September last year, and this lady is called Mata. That's the pastor of our church. Now, in Colombia, they create what they call solidarity collectives. These are groups of women. They join together. Many of them, particularly in this area where they operate, many of them are widows because their husband have been killed because of narco traffic and narco traffic violence. In some cases, either the husband may have been working with the police or were judges or magistrates, and you know, they are primary target. But in this particular community, they organize themselves as part of self-defense. And what they do when they organize themselves is to what we call the small collective. They are basic, even before you can talk about helping each other, the basic study is Bible, and the solidarity is founded on the Bible. Before they can even move to the next level. And these groups are so strong that if one member is unable to pay a loan, you know, because they all guarantee for each other, they pay. But if one member dies, you know, the group that remains pays the loan for the others. And this lady, we invited her to our meeting. And she said she got very fed up because people are talking about the pro and con of one year. So she stood up and said, look, what we need is dignity and respect. We don't need your money. If you don't respect us, keep your money. But if you respect us, we are capable and we are not asking for handout. Even if you are lending to us, we want it to be done in a way that is respectful of us and our own culture. She has a shop. She is now a net worth of about $25,000. Again, within this context, that may not appear to be a lot of money. But in her context, she started virtually nothing. She had only one machine. And she has a family of four. And she is the sole breadwinner because she has no husband. And what she does now is she no longer borrows, but she helps to support new coming members and produce the program in other groups. That's another corrective. This is someone who is working on the street, making pizzas on the street. Again, she used to be harassed by the police. So they joined, and they joined together with her child. Her child is very understanding. You know, and they have to give and stand. So you have your own stand here, you have your own stand here. She's a widow. She's a family of five. And she's a sole breadwinner. She looked very happy. She does not require anybody's handout because she's able now to earn money on her own. Now, probably one of the most intensive in terms of financial training, because we tend to be little people. This is a program that is operating in Bolivia. It's very, very intensive. You get a loan of $80 at the beginning, but that loan is guaranteed by three or four people. Nobody asks you what you're going to do with that money. But of course, the people guaranteeing for you, and then they trust you, if they think you are going to use the money on alcohol, of course they will guarantee for you. But the organization that is ready does not ask you. Just take the money, and the loan must be approved within 7 days. Once you get a guarantee of three or five people. Then 3 months, you pay back, you borrow a high amount. Then you get a third loan, you borrow a high amount. Then you get a fourth loan, you borrow a high amount. Until you get the maximum, $250. This is very intensive financial training. Because in terms of business training, credit and credit management, in terms of thinking what is the activity that's going to give you the highest return within where you are. And they are all doing different things, they're not doing the same thing. Now, to be able to do that, you really must work from where the people are. So, our organization there opened an office, and you see the people queuing up. And the office remains open 7 days a week. Because if somebody wants the loan, must be able to get it. If somebody wants to pay back, the person must be able to get it. So it's open 7 days a week throughout the year. This is probably one of the largest programs. And what we have seen from this program, actually, poor people are creditworthy. Because they give about 50, 60 loans, $1 million, and about 95%. You know, people borrow and pay back. And these are very, very small loans. So in effect, from our own experience, I think, you know, the poor are not necessarily waiting for handout. As long as an enabling environment is established. And the relationship, when you lend somebody money, is very different from the relationship when you are giving the person money. But there are cases when an outright donation is the only way out. Because if you give a loan, where it is the wrong solution. Then it's like you are putting a meal around someone's neck. So that is the same. Same country, Bolivia. Now this is. I thought I would share this with you. This is in Hungary. Because even after the revolution, the communist revolution, 1956, this program started in Hungary in 1915. And even after the revolution, the program continued. It was a very interesting experience during the days of communism to be able to support the work of the church, because here we are exclusively working to support the work of the church. I compare it from Hungary. This is in Trinidad and Tobago. This is the Anglican Church. And you see, the congregation borrowed money to put up a new building. Now, many people are very, this is something many people are opposed to. Why should you lend money to a congregation, not to do business, but to put up our seats, sanctuary? I think for me, it has a very deep meaning. Because what the congregation is saying, look, in the wrong land, we take responsibility for our own activities. We'll see this when we go further. This is in Ghana. It's a primary school in Ghana. This primary school, they borrowed funds to put up four classrooms. Again, this is social, you know, this is it's a social service, because this is a church school, it's not a business school. Now, that is in, this is another school in Swaziland. Swaziland is in southern Africa, you say, and close by South Africa. Again, this is a community school, and they got stuck because they did not have enough classrooms. So they borrowed money to put three classrooms. When they had finished, they got two more classrooms from the government. And they got five new teachers from the government. Now this particular school is very unique in the sense that, you see, they don't have, the repayment schedule is very flexible, because they donate a cow. Every homestead donates a cow every year. Then those cows are auctioned. And that's how they pay back the loan and the principal. Again, you see, the community, this particular community, what in effect they are saying, in the wrong land, whether it is in education, they take direct responsibility. Because most of the countries, again, we operate, it's not like, probably like here, I don't know the situation here, but education is not supported by the government. The parents are required to participate. If you cannot be able to put an input, then you don't get help from the government. So when you get, but if you give them time, because they put up the classrooms, then they continue fundraising from their own resources. So instead of waiting to have classrooms in 3 years, they're able to have classrooms today for the students to come into school today. And then they continue collecting and doing fundraising so that then they have the funds and the classrooms available. This is a very culturally closed society. When I'm not sure that I admired everything that was going on, because although it is good, but the king has been using culture to keep a lead on the people, and the people have started rebelling. So this is also one case where you start to be proud of your own culture, but at the same time, it is refused to continue oppression. Now, that's the... I would like to put just very, very briefly into context
Yeah. Did I hide the switch?
Yeah. It is.
This is just to put into context the different type of activities that people use small-scale credit to support themselves. And you see micro-enterprises, that is agriculture. This is education and training. These are social services. And you have church buildings. The biggest portion in that is agriculture and micro-enterprises. It's credit for women is very, very significant. And about 52% of the credit goes to women. And the women are the best payers. In fact, although this has a consequence also, because studies have been done, and the people are asking themselves, what is the sacrifice they are making in order to maintain their name? Is somebody paying at the expense of maybe an extra pint of milk for the family? And also, if they are involved in all these activities, and they also have domestic, other domestic activities that they are involved in, are we already over-exploiting a sector or population which is already over-exploited? So I want to stop there, sorry if time is up. What I intend to do tomorrow is to provide a linkage, is a video which provides a linkage, a global linkage, and you have the people speaking for themselves in different countries. And also the, so that you have the global linkage and the linkage between the countries and the linkage between the communities. And the different partners that we are working with, because it is we are working both with the churches outside and in the different countries, and also churches globally, including churches that are based in the United States, that we are working together. If primarily in offering and helping and challenging the churches to look at alternative ways of addressing the problem of poverty. And also asking the churches, including in our own countries, that don't just look at the needs of the pastor, but see that you have a congregation and you have poor members in the congregation. So there is a tool that the church can be able to use to be able to support the members of the congregation. Thank you.